Hello and welcome back to the Doomer Optimism podcast. Just Ashley here hosting today with Jeffrey, known on Twitter as Long Story Farms. This is a second in a series of friends who I've recruited to ask me or to for me to ask, you know, their stories of homecoming, their stories of coming home from not living at what they think of as their home. And as I'm ruminating on this question of home with my family, deciding where we want to settle, I'm sort of picking the brains of others who have gone before me and kind of made the leap to go back home, and ask them sort of their perspective about why, you know, what constitutes home, what's a good place to settle. I think a lot of people are really, you know, kind of thinking about migrating or thinking about trying to settle somewhere safe. And so hopefully this is useful beyond just me, but it's also kind of a therapy session for me individually. So welcome, Jeffrey. Let me have you just briefly introduce yourself, and then we'll dig into your story about being away and coming back home.
Sounds great. Yeah, well, thank you so much for having me. I'm son of dirt farmers. My mom and dad both grew up on farms in South Carolina. And along the way, you know, they got more education than their ancestors had. And that was a big focus of our family to make sure that myself and my siblings all got educated. So, you know, we had these big aspirations. I've ended up working in corporate finance as a, mostly in financial operations and financial planning, for those that know that space at all. And, you know, the reason we're doing the farm thing is a few years ago, 12 years ago, my dad passed away. And it was like a switch that flipped in me, and I had to go figure out how to do a farm. So I started thinking about it really hard in that time frame. And we started actually, we bought land in 2014, and we started actually, you know, farming really in about 2 years ago. So 2021 was when we actually started going to our first farmers markets. And we're kind of stuck. I'm still working in corporate finance. We're kind of stuck at a scale that we want to try to get over that hump, but it's hard, trying to manage, you know, living in two lives, which I think is another topic we probably should talk about a little bit, living in two different kind of realities to a certain degree. Mm-hmm. But yeah, corporate finance guy by day, farmer on the weekends, father and husband. Those would be probably the things that are relevant.
Yeah. Okay. So let's start with the original part of the story, which I've heard this, you know, this is like common, not just in the US, but like all around the world, where people were more working class or rural farmers or whatever. And a lot of those jobs just kind of went away, either through consolidation, for example, with farming, you know, it just turned into like bigger and bigger farms, more and more industrial, to the point you didn't need as many people on the land. This idea of like moving up or moving away from the farm, moving away from a small town, as like the place for ambition. Let's talk a little bit about that, because on the one hand, it is totally fair that if you're trying to like be more elite, more ambitious, you are going to want to go to the cities. And that's historically true. It's been true throughout most of human history. But there is also like a subtext story where like the values of staying in a place, it's like a backwards thing to do, or like you're wasting your talent or something like that. So let's talk a little bit about like what that was like first.
Yeah, perfect. Let me talk about my dad first. My dad grew up on a farm. He was one of five boys and a girl, so one of six. He was a twin. His father was an educator, a teacher, and his father ended up becoming the principal of a high school. Worked in education through the civil rights movement and up until the 80s when he retired. And they had a farm, and his father was a teacher. That was the way they, you know, they were an educator, off-farm educator, but they had a big farm. They were farming about 365 acres, if I remember correctly. As a kid, I was on that farm, participated in slaughtering hogs, participated in other chores whenever we would visit. Heard, at the feet of my father and grandfather, heard discussions of the PIC program, which was really common, in the set in the I think late 70s. That was like the Earl Butz era, when progressive. I would sit in my grandfather's couch and read Progressive Farmer magazine. So I was hearing all these things, and I was, I had this dream as a kid of, I was going to be at the helm of this, John Deere tractor, just, tilling and planting and combining thousands of acres or something like that. Kind of, I just had this, childhood dream of being a farmer. So, grew up like that. My dad, though, growing up in that environment, he was always encouraged to be, to get a college education. He went to a college called Newberry College, which is where we live now. It's a Lutheran college. The area we live in is settled by, it's called the Dutch Fork. Saxe-Gotha and Dutch Fork were two different waves of migration of German immigrants that settled in this area. Our family's probably more part of the earlier migration, which was Saxe-Gotha, but we live in an area called the Dutch Fork. There's a Lutheran church on every corner. Newberry College is a Lutheran college. My dad went to Newberry College. That was the option that was available. Played baseball, and he became a teacher. And I asked him, I was like, "Dad, why'd you become a teacher?" And he goes, "Well, Newberry College made teachers and preachers, and I didn't want to be a preacher." So, he became a preacher, or sorry, rather a teacher and a coach. Met my mother, and was moving around with teaching jobs. And then he started selling corn for a company called DeKalb AgriSearch. So back in the day, there were these two brands that were, at least in my imagination as a kid, were like these titans of, agricultural seed companies. You had DeKalb AgriSearch and Pioneer. That's what I remember as a kid. And now DeKalb AgriSearch is actually bought by Monsanto, so I don't really know all the history of all that, but he would go around when, as a kid, he would go around planting test plots and doing all these different things. And we lived in all up and down the Eastern Seaboard. He eventually ended up back in South Carolina. He had a really good reputation, and his job there as a salesperson was widely viewed as being the most honest and upright and all this stuff. And he got a new boss, and the new boss was like, "You're too honest to be a to work for me." And my dad's like, "Well, if that's how you feel, I agree." And they decided to part ways. And my dad then went to school. He bounced around some different things, did some carpentry, some different things, but he ultimately went back to school and became a chiropractor, right? But he was in South Carolina living, 45 miles from my grandfather, on my dad's side, and another maybe hour to my mother's family. So we were close to them. We went to Georgia for chiropractic college, came back in the early 80s, and I was living in this area, right? And living in this area, having access to the farms of my grandparents, spent one entire summer, the summer I was 13 or I turned 13, right after my grandfather retired as a principal, spent the whole summer working in his garden, and his garden was like a 5-acre truck farm. So taught me how to plant tomatoes, would go to market with him. I had all this, I was involved in it and I enjoyed it. But when you go to school in these rural communities, there's always that one teacher or more than one teacher, who is saying, you're too bright to stay here. You shouldn't be held back by this, little podunk town. What are you, you could do whatever. You should, go off to the big city and get an education and do great things." And I bought into that, completely bought into that. And by the time I got to, college and stuff, I was doing econ and French as a major, double major. Fully planned on, at that time, becoming a PhD in economics, and teaching at some liberal arts university, or working in the basement of an investment bank, and whatever. And I ended up having a car accident. Couldn't continue that. After I started the PhD, couldn't continue that. ended up getting an MBA, marrying a woman from Venezuela. And at that point, I was like, I'm going to be, a financial executive and, go off and exploit third world countries or whatever, whatever the thing is. So at that point, I had really no desire to be, South Carolina didn't matter to me. Whatever, it's like kind of that was the past, didn't matter. I'm looking to the future. And ended up working for a company, in the it, well, in certain companies. I was traveling a lot in Latin America. I'm fluent in Spanish and French, so I was traveling a lot in Latin America. Did well, and ultimately got this opportunity to, I changed jobs. So, well, let me go back. Sorry. So I'm doing well. I end up moving back to South Carolina after an acquisition of a company I work for. And in that move back, a couple of years after that, I was commuting to Mexico basically almost weekly. And my mom died of cancer. And I was like, why, why do we move back from Florida to South Carolina, kind of just, until things worked out kind of thing. It wasn't like coming home to me at that point in time. It was just kind of like a stopover, My mom passed away. I got a different job not long after that. And a couple years later, my dad passed away. And all of a sudden, it's like you feel like there's this hand of, I'll just say, the hand of God in your life, that you happen to be near your parents for those moments. And so at that point, we're really looking at, I'm looking at life very differently. As the oldest son, losing my dad, like I said a minute ago, big switch for me. It's like, hey, my dad was kind of a typical prepper type, always had a garden, always had stored food, canned food, et cetera. That's gone. My chiropractor's gone. My dad, who was always a superhero to me, always extremely capable to do whatever, anything, he knew how to do something about it. Like he could fix, wasn't a mechanic, but he could fix stuff. He wasn't a carpenter, but he could build stuff kind of guy. I guess I kind of, was like, hey, who's going to be that for my kids, kind of thing. So that's when we started really looking, two things, looking for land. And looking to grow our own food. So we were working, we lived in a courtyard home. So I ended up with about 300 square feet of raised beds, growing about 60 different plant species. I had fruit trees. I had six chickens all in this little courtyard. Eventually the neighbors and the HOA got wind of it. So, moved on from that. What happened was I decided at one point, okay, I really want to get back to the land, as in the, aftermath of my dad passing away. Went to Polyface for a Food Freedom Weekend. So that's
Oh,
Joel
yeah.
Salatin's farm. Went up there for a Food Freedom Weekend, and I thought, I can do this. And that's when I started looking for land. And in that all that space, I started really, space of time, started really like thinking about what is home and why did I ever leave. Like, why did I leave? Why did I try to get rid of my Southern accent? Why was I embarrassed by that? All these things, like questioning my own identity, really. So we ended up finding land here, and ironically, I signed the contract in January, and in April I was asked to move to Chile by my company.
So I was wondering where Chile went into this. So let's hear the Chile part, because now we have the shared experience of living in South America and thinking about, life here versus life there. So yeah, let's talk about Chile.
Well, we had done two stints, short stints, one in Mexico, one in Chile, because we homeschooled and we were flexible and we could do that. And the company was like, perfect, we'll send you wherever we need you. And it's no big deal. We're like, yeah, no big deal. So then all of a sudden, this opportunity came up to go to Chile, move to Chile. At the time, it was like a good opportunity for the kids and stuff like that. And it was a good opportunity professionally. And it just seemed to make sense. So we moved down there. It was in 2014. And man, we loved it down there. My wife is Venezuelan, so the language was not a big issue for us. Our kids struggled a little bit, but not too bad. we quickly integrated with the church community and with some people at the American school through Boy Scouts, even though we continue to homeschool. So we had a good little community there. Just really enjoyed it. Beautiful country. Totally recommend it to anybody for travel or if you want to go live somewhere else. Great place. Really, really enjoyed it. Spent probably at least one weekend a month sleeping in tents, at least. And we were constantly going hiking and camping and just thoroughly enjoyed all that. No, I always joke around, there's no chiggers, there's no ticks, a few mosquitoes, no poisonous snakes. Shake out your shoes, make sure there's no scorpions or spiders, and you're good to go, basically. There's really nothing to worry about like there is here in South Carolina. If you go, first of all, it's unbearable to camp in the summer here, but if you do go camping, you have to be careful if you step over a stick that it's not a snake or there's not a snake under it. You know, it's like just a yeah, very different vibe to enjoying the outdoors there. We got to travel quite a lot in the region. One of the things I think that's really relevant to this conversation is when you moved somewhere, you have this idea that you are going away from home, but the home is still wherever you left. Like that's kind of the way you feel. Home is where I left. So you go to this other place and in your mind, home is still where you were. So we moved in September. I was down there from basically April, May. We moved family in September. In December, we came back home for Christmas and we were like, oh, great. We're going back home and we're going to see our friends. It's going to be great. And we got back home and everyone's like, oh yeah, I'm sorry, man. I got family in town or what, you know. We weren't there. We weren't part of their lives anymore. We weren't part of their day to day. After 3 or 4 months, we weren't really home anymore when we went back. And so that was really a weird feeling. And it was like, well, you know, it's holidays. Okay, no big deal. We planned to come back the next summer. We came back the next summer. We're going to stay for like 6 weeks. And I'm thinking the same thing. Hey, you know, reintegrate with our friends. We're going to, you know, we're back home. We get to do the things we used to do. Didn't work out that way. And we resolved at that point not to come back to these states until we were finished with our stint in Chile. So yeah.
And I, let me just add to that. I want to hear more about this story, but I have had very similar experiences where it's like when you go back, you know, all the kids, for example, they have their activities, they have their life, they have their routines, and like your kids can see them maybe on weekends or something like that, but they're not like in baseball, they're not in summer camp, they're not in all of this stuff that the kids are in. And so then it's a little bit lonely for the kids too. It's not really like you're part of it until you're there. So I have very similar experience. So anyways, continue.
Yeah, that was exactly what it was. It's like, hey, you're not in the homeschool co-op anymore. You're not in the baseball team. You're not in the Boy Scout group or whatever. So, you know, we just can't squeeze you in to the rest of our
Yeah, and then, you know, the other thing I experience is like the only time you get to see people then is like in a social activity, like come over to play or come over for like a party or something like that. But then it's like this exhausting, constant party socializing, which is different from like Boy Scout socializing or baseball team socializing. It's like like you're constantly like at this level where you're like super deeply engaged. But then every time we left Chicago, it's like I'm so exhausted because we have so many people to see, but the socializing is at like this party level where we have to catch up for like a year of lost time. So yeah, anyways, it is like it's just a different social dynamic totally.
Talk completely. And I think the other thing that happens is you do that and you also think you have stayed the same. And you are changing and you're being changed by your environment in ways you never thought of. The news reporting in outside the US is different. Mm-hmm. The way the US is perceived is very different. And so that imprint on you is very, like I came back and my politics was completely different. Like, you know, I wasn't like less conservative or traditional, not conservative politically, but I wasn't less conservative in my views or my, you know, my kind of appeal to tradition as a source of, you know, cultural constancy and things like that. All those things stayed pretty the same. I stopped seeing the political solutions that were being offered as compatible or, you know, synchronous with the way that I saw the world. I just didn't see the political solutions matching that anymore. And people don't know how to deal with that. I mean, all of a sudden it's like, some of those voices I might have listened to in the past just sounded shrill. I just was like, who listens to this, And I mean, I'll use an example, not someone I ever really was a big fan of, but someone that probably fits in that camp. It may be like a very, I don't know. So take someone like Tucker Carlson or whatever. Like you might listen to that, and if you're in the States all the time and you're thinking, this represents a point of view that resonates with me at some level, whether you agree or disagree, doesn't matter. Just, like you, it sounds grounded in reality. You leave the States, come back a year and a half, 2 years later, and you're like, this doesn't even match reality to me anymore. Like it doesn't sound like the same thing. And the other thing is like how impactful the US is on other people. Like that's another thing I don't think we appreciate if you're here in the States is, people care about US elections and US policy because it impacts their day-to-day life. And the more it matters, the less importance I want to give it. In other words, like I want to diminish the importance of the outcome of those policy decisions and election, elections here in the States because I want to impact other people's lives outside the US less. Like I want to take power away from those things because it's very damaging, even within the, within Latin America. And those countries have not been targeted the way other countries have in the very recent past, but in the more, midterm past, they were very impacted by, US policy decisions. And so it's just perspective completely changed. Okay, so we decided to stay, and this was really revelatory to me because when we decided to stay, all of a sudden home became where we were, right? It became Chile, it became Santiago. So when we traveled within the region, and I think the traveling within the region also helped to reinforce that idea of when we come back, we are coming back to Santiago. So we would go, I mean, some of the trips we took, and we were very fortunate. I mean, I don't say this in a any kind of like prideful way. Just we were very fortunate. We used our travel budget entirely within the region. So we went to Pucón, Patagonia, Atacama, Iguazu, Galapagos, Easter Island. We
So
got to
wow.
see all of that. So we spent time in Buenos Aires, we spent time in Guayaquil, we spent time in, we went to Machu Picchu. So we just decided, hey, we're going to see everything we can in the region. We camped a lot, so we didn't spend as much money, but we did have some benefits from our company that enabled that. I mean, I'm not saying that, we weren't independently wealthy. We just said we had some benefits we took advantage of. We tried to be careful, and we were able to see a lot of things. And your kids don't really appreciate it right away, but now they do, and that's really been a great thing. But that idea of leaving and then coming back within the region reinforced that idea of Santiago as home. When it was time to come back to the States, it felt very, very weird. It felt just as bad as leaving the States. Like I can't explain it, but yeah, I mean, there was this like excitement about coming back where you would be closer to some family members and things like that. But there was also just completely, uprooting everything again. Like we had put down some roots there. We had a community, we had friends, we had a lot of things that we enjoyed there, and it was very different to come back. So one of the things that happened along the way, I had a guy who had also been an expat, and he was actually from Brazil and lived in the States. He gave me a book. I'll remember and send you this. You can put it in the show notes or something, but it was basically like this book for expats, something like You Can Never Go Home, something like that. So I think that really resonates with me because of this feeling of what home is. Like it completely changed depending on our perspective. Home stayed, Columbia, South Carolina when we were first moved to Chile. Then home became Santiago. And now home is here in Newberry, South Carolina. And home means a lot here because we own land that we're working on every day to improve and to to extract nourishment from and to put fertility back in and all the different things we're doing on the land that creates a very strong sense of home. But I've also become more aware of the past and where my ancestors came from, how they got here, what they did here, the lives they led here, their history. I don't know much about their American Revolution history. I know that there were some people that were engaged because they got here in the 1740s. But definitely the Civil War was had a big impact. The Civil Rights era had a big impact. So just becoming aware of that past and that history that is now part of home to me because I'm becoming more educated about it. So I don't know if that helps, but that's kind of the journey, I
Well, okay,
guess.
yeah, let me jump in for a second and just kind of reflect. Like, I think a couple of things come out to for or stand out for me. First, this idea that I'm kind of ambivalent. Like, I still am concerned about the United States as like a super functional place to live. Of course. I had a I shared this experience. My experience in Uruguay has been so lovely. The people here have been so nice. They've been so friendly. The home that we've made on this land and managing it has been so satisfying. It's been lovely. But despite all of that, which is like it really was a pretty great experience overall and continues to be. Despite all of that, there is there where we have reached a kind of point at which two things. One, where I'm thinking about my parents getting older, and just thinking about like, they're not going to live infinitely long lives, and having memories with them, especially with the grandchildren, is something that like really just can't be spreadsheet brained away. Like there's no like, talking about like, oh, America's in a collapsing empire. Yeah, I still think that, but also like having, my kids who are 3, 7, and 10 spend the next decade or, two with their grandparents and getting them to see what that experience is like, which little kids are so they're so adorable. This is the most fun time. Just sharing that like wealth of experience together is totally, there's no price you can put on it. It's just so important. And then my sister and brother have kids and they're starting to get old enough to like make memories and the cousins all together. And there's something that's just infinitely wealthy about that. That just, no matter we have tons of friends here, but they're not our family, so that's a different thing. And I've just kind of come to this realization that like really there's nothing that can replace that, those kind of family relationships. And then the other thing is my kids' young childhood has been so wholesome here, which is what I really wanted. I mean, I was really worried about early childhood like damage in US public schools or among US like peers. But they're kind of out of the early childhood stage, starting to get out of it, especially the oldest. And now the oldest is getting to the point where she's 10, where the culture really matters, where it's not like, oh, we're all the same because we're in like preschool and young grade school. Now it's like, who's your favorite pop star? What do you dress like? And she's starting to feel this tension of like being raised in a US family with like US sensibilities, and then that butting up against with her like local friends and their sensibilities, and this feeling of like being an outsider, which I think is kind of tough. I mean, it's good to learn Spanish, it's good to get immersed in a different culture. But there is like a point at which, and even I would say for Patrick and I too, we've made friends, but there's like a limit, it's like calculus or something, there's a limit to closeness that we can have with the local friends. They're as friendly as they can be. They're super nice. But it can't get super deep because of like language and cultural barriers. And so we're kind of reaching that point where I'm starting to get deeper with my family from afar and my, internet friends than I am with like my local friends. And it would just be so nice to have in-person relationships where I can really go deep, and it's hard to have those deep relationships, like with my sister, by a phone call, every couple days, as opposed to just sitting in each other's living room and getting to talk, deeply about, things that are harder to talk about across language and cultural barriers,
Yeah, and sometimes I think some of those things are not the deep things. It's the trivial things that you probably wouldn't think about talking about on a phone call, but they end up being, making an imprint on the way you view culture even. I don't know. I mean, I one of the things that is a huge loss if you don't recognize it. And I think it's easy to recognize when you live in a different country, but think of all the idiomatic expressions that where like especially where I am in the South, there's a lot of them that are dying away, dying off with
Yeah.
the probably this at least the younger boomers, I'll say. I'm sorry, the older boomers, the older boomers. Like, so my dad would have been probably he was in that he was a war baby, so that generation is they're dying off. We're going to lose a lot of cultural richness. And you kind of become more aware of that when you live in a different country with a different language because of how much stuff you don't understand.
Yeah.
Right? Like someone says something, you're like, what does that even mean? Like, I know what all the words mean, but that doesn't make any sense at all, right?
Yeah, totally. I
So.
mean, it's like at this what you when we were talking about this, it reminds me, my dad and his generation in Chicago says the word jag off. Look at this jag off, and it's like our
Yeah.
generation doesn't say that really. And the same, there's so many phrases like that in Uruguay and Spanish where I'm like, yeah, I know what the words mean, but I don't know like the cultural context of this phrase, like, and who uses
Yeah.
it and whether it would be appropriate for me to use or not, and like. There's just so much mental energy around that, and especially me, because I'm kind of like high conscientiousness around social situations. I don't want to say something stupid, and I want to be really appropriate and say things that are in the right context. But it would be like a long conversation with people constantly asking like the history of this phrase and who uses it. And a lot of times in people's normal vernacular, they don't even really know, or they don't have ever really thought of it. It's such a common thing. They're not thinking like, oh, well, this generation uses that or whatever. They'd have to like think about it. It's not like, something they're equipped to tell a foreigner. And so there's a lot of stuff like that where like the mental energy is just starting to get so much to be able to do this day-to-day stuff.
And yeah, I think that's gonna be a rich experience for your kids to come back. Yeah, but I think they're gonna feel, they're gonna feel completely uprooted, and it's gonna feel probably scary, there was a it's weird, like for me at least. I've traveled quite a bit for work, and I guess I've been to about 30-ish countries, 30 couple countries maybe, mostly big cities. And the level of feelings, the feeling of safety, and the level of situational awareness you have to maintain in some of those places is very different. And living in a small town essentially in Uruguay probably feels super safe most of the time, I would think. I don't know. Anyway, how you guys
It's
feel
almost, I mean, that was a part of the
there?
thing we said, people, why did you come here? Because it's boring. And then they always laugh, but we're like, no, but it really is like that. It is so boring. There's no crime. Everybody leaves their door open. Everybody knows one another. It's, it is ideal. Like, it's like Mayberry. I mean, it's really, it is a super lovely, very safe, very calm place. But in some ways, it's funny because I think probably a lot of people think like, oh, you guys went to this foreign country, like look at this amazing adventure. But in some ways, being in Chicago is going to be, and I know it is because I've lived there obviously most of my life, much more like situational awareness, engagement with the best parts of the city, and like yeah, just like a more a mentally taxing than life here, which is just kind of like very sleepy, very calm, very relaxed.
I mean, Santiago was obviously, a big city where crime was an issue, especially petty crime. There was a lot of like in Spanish they call it hurtado, but basically, you leave something unattended, turn your back for a minute and it's gone kind of stuff. It wasn't like violent crime. Like, it wasn't like Mexico where they tap on your window with a pistol and go give him your watch. It was
Right.
more like, oh, look, he's not looking. I'll grab his computer kind
Yeah,
of stuff.
that happened to me in Spain a bunch. Yeah, similar kind of thing.
Yeah.
You don't feel like physically assaulted, but your thing is just gone.
Yeah. Yeah. And you're sitting and you're mad at yourself because you knew better and you're just mad at yourself. And it's not, you're not even really mad at the criminal as much as you are at yourself because you're
Yeah,
like, oh,
I
I
should
knew
have known
better, you know?
better. Yeah.
And then you see people walking down the street that are Americans that have never been in that environment, like walking on the street, talking on their, like, not talking, but like scrolling Instagram on their phone while they're walking. You're sitting there going, oh my gosh, you're gonna get just taken.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it's gonna be different, coming back to Chicago, because I think it'll be kind of the reverse of what I was just saying, where your kids are gonna have to be a little bit more aware and, buddies or something, take a buddy or whatever. I don't know how you manage it, but yeah, that would be different. Yeah.
Talk to me a little bit about then, the process of coming back, what it's been like. Talk me through it. I guess I should just say too, for the record, like we're a couple months away from going. We're talking to the kids about it constantly. I think it's going to be hardest on the 10-year-old because the other two are kind of young enough to not feel like, the 10-year-old's starting to develop a real friend group, and the 7 and 3-year-old, they kind of could pick and choose whomever. And I was
Yeah.
just talking to her last night, and we're painting the inside of the house for, preparing to take everything out of it and maybe rent it out. And my husband takes down this like Harry Potter sticker thing my daughter had on the wall, and she just loses it crying. And I'm like, oh, like we didn't talk to her about it. And she's like, this is my special thing, like, this is my room. This is all I've ever known. And so we had this long talk about this, like we're, this is like the price of moving. And I'm gonna a have to ask you to be brave about it and to, try to think of it as an opportunity to be strong and think of it as a challenge and this kind of thing. But yeah, I mean, I think it is a big deal, and I acknowledge that with her. And I, but I then, last time we came back from the US, my daughters are all super articulate on their feelings, like since they were babies. And the oldest and the middle were both saying, like, I don't know, it just feels like we belong more in the US. Like every time we go back there's more belonging, more sense of this is home as opposed to Uruguay. And all of us kind of felt that all at once. And so, I think they're looking forward to it, but it's just one of those things, like, okay, well, if we're gonna go back there, this is gonna be the price of it. And I'm sorry, and it's tough, and I'm sorry that I have to that we did this, but I think it'll be good for you. Like, this one thing we talk about on Doomer Optimism is this, it's like challenge shouldn't cross over the threshold to trauma. Like it should be a challenge enough that you're not like damaged by it, but you think of it as a challenge and as something that's like making you stronger. So anyways, yeah, so let's talk about your return. How did it
Yeah.
go? And yeah.
Well, let me go back then, because I think more relevant is really the experience our youngest had moving from the States to Chile. Like, we left our house, we got rid of our car,
Yeah.
and those things were like these anchors for him. It's like, oh my gosh, that's like, I don't know any other house, I don't know any other car.
Yeah, how old was
How
he?
could you get rid of it? He was 8 when we left.
Okay, yeah, okay, yeah.
I think there's a, and according to what we read when we were getting ready for the move, and some of the counseling that we were able to get from like the relocation, because when companies do this stuff, they have these people to help you through it.
Yeah, okay.
So we had like this counselor that was kind of talking us through it, and they were saying that like that age, that 8 to 10 age group is really hard because of they're starting to develop this sense of identity, and they're relating certain things to that identity, and you don't know what it is. So if in your case it's this, whatever this, what would you say it was, the
Hey, it was
Harry
a
Potter
Harry
thing that you
Potter
put?
like sticker art she made. Yeah.
And so for our kid, he's like, I can't believe, like, he'll still stay every now and then, he'll still say, I can't believe we sold the Red Expedition. And I'm like, dude, that thing was trashed. Like, it's not a permanent fixture in our
Yeah.
life,
Yeah.
But so he experienced a lot of problems with that, with the leaving part, leaving to go to Chile. The coming back part was hard more than anything because we didn't come back to where we left. So we came back to Newberry, which is about 45 minutes or so, 35, 45 minutes from where we used to live. And so we kind of were a little bit too far to kind of replug into some of those
Oh
groups.
yeah, okay.
So it was a new thing, and it's a more rural town. It's also the county is much more diverse, like almost 40% African American, and there's quite a few Hispanics, mostly Mexican descent. And we were homeschooling, so in a small county with that demographic, there wasn't like a homeschool co-op at the ready.
Yeah.
And so kind of a hard reintegration. We still did find like a pretty good church community, but it wasn't as many kids in it. So it was kind of like, still felt very isolated. I think the kids and I think some of the kids suffered a lot from that more than anything else. I think that was like the one thing we could have done better would have been to make sure we, even if we had to drive further, we got them back into some other peer groups. That was just very, very hard from a landing perspective. I came back into a job role that was pretty demanding. It was a lot of travel. So I was kind of leaving my wife and kids to handle a lot of those things. And we were living in an apartment. Like I think there's a lot of circumstances that influenced this. What I guess I'm trying to say is like we were living in an apartment with the land, trying to get the land in a condition where we could start, our food forest and some of these other things. So there was it also felt very impermanent that we were living in this apartment, knowing that we wanted to move to our land. And so I think there was a lot of things that felt very transitory from the time we moved back until probably 2019 when we moved to the land. So I think that was another big thing. I think you guys have a maybe an advantage because you're going to a place that you've selected to be kind of home from for now, right?
Actually, I mean, we're kind of opposites because you're moving from a South American city back to the States, but ideally in the rural area, and I'm doing the opposite, moving from a rural South American area to the city. But we are like th we talked about this when we were moving back, and even trying to discuss whether or not to move to the neighborhood Patrick and I grew up in, where like our family members live versus the suburbs, I was like, I don't care. I'm going psychotically, no, the known quantity, which is our neighborhood we grew up in, that both of our families live in, that I know all of the neighborhood schools, I know the high schools, a lot of my neighbors are going to be people I went to high school with, like psychotically known, to the point that my kids are going to be a couple blocks away from their cousins, my sister. My sister's already taking pictures of, there are kids outside her neighbor kids who go to the public school that my kids are going to go to, and they all walk to school together. So my sister's trying to like recruit this kid group for my daughters to go walk with them to school. Like all of that stuff is going to be like a super easy integration. Once we get there, we bought a house that's going to be our landing place. It's going to be our home. So like I'm feeling pretty confident at least about that setup. One thing I'm ambivalent about is living in a city again. After having done this rural thing and like really realizing the importance of it, I do think my parents live in like a 20 minutes away suburb, and they have like a couple acres, so I think I can do some stuff with their land, which they're not really doing anything with it. Which will be fun, but I'm wondering whether we can just riff a little bit on like the in general the two worlds conversation, which I think ties in having a having you know a an office job or a remote job, and wanting to do some things on the land. I think for me, like also having a remote job, living in the city, like doing this whole globalist thing that I don't want to really do, but this is where my family's from, but also wanting to maintain this connection to like productivity and landedness and rural areas and that kind of thing. So yeah, just wondering if we can let's talk about this
Sure.
two
Yeah,
worlds conversation.
I think one of the really important things, I was talking to Homestead Padre the other night, and he was talking about, hey, if you've got a balcony or a 5 gallon bucket, you can grow something, So I think, no matter what, it's like wherever you are, there is something. You can grow herbs in your kitchen counter. You can grow tomatoes in a bucket on the balcony, and you can get more sophisticated from there. And if you've got a couple of acres, there's no reason not to, know, if your parents are up for it, no reason not to even have a few chickens unless the zoning doesn't allow
No,
it.
but even Chicago lets you have
And
chickens. So
even,
we're definitely getting chickens in Chicago for sure.
yeah. So I mean, I like I said, I started off growing all this stuff in a courtyard. I mean, it was literally a brick courtyard. I don't know the exact measurements, but I had about 300 square feet of raised beds, and I was growing things that were very successful. I was great carrots, did great with tomatoes, great with greens and bunch of squash and cucumbers and all this kind of stuff. I didn't do great with corn because it was too small of a space, and the wind pollination, I just didn't get that figured out. But we grew a ton of stuff in very small space, and I think there's a lot of ways to approach it from a square foot gardening perspective, or whatever, vertical gardening or other things that there's lots of ways to do it. So yeah, definitely don't be deterred. But let me talk more about, like, I have a really good friend, and I've said before that if I ever decide to host a podcast episode here, I'll invite him on. But he was a really good friend of mine. We met through homeschool, and he's a permaculture guy. He teaches wild foraging classes, does permaculture consulting, does carpentry, does art. Super talented guy. We're close in age. Just a great, great guy. And he chose the path of doing what he loved. And I chose the path of you're too bright to stay here. You should go, whatever. So here we are now, where I have maybe I have the income, or I have whatever, I can do certain things. He has that freedom, and he has the ability to do all these things. And we talk about that contrast all the time. Like, he has time, I have maybe the means. I have no time. He all that can't always get the thing that he wants or whatever. And we talk about that constantly. Huge trade-offs. I'm getting to an age where I'm starting to think about that trade-off more, because the longer I persist in this duality, the less I can focus and dedicate, on the things I really love, right? So I've got to start figuring out how long I can live in both worlds. But there's a couple of areas where I think the two world conversation is really important. One is that, and the other is the idea of, the doomer side versus the optimism side, right? So, and then I think another duality that's really critical is urban and rural, which we kind of talked about all three of those, I think, at some point today. But so that duality of living in the kind of the corporate, job space versus being a farmer, it feels really weird sometimes, a lot of tension. It does feel like LARPing sometimes, and then other times you feel like, hey, we're doing this, and it's great. So I tension, but I think I'm not answering your question, but those are some of my thoughts about the dualities that we're having to confront, and it's a tension and a paradox you just have to deal with.
I mean, the one thing that I think a lot about is okay, so we I wrote this article for Front Porch Republic about this, but there's this FIRE movement, financial independence, retire early. And early on in my career, my academic career, I was thinking about, okay, well, there's nothing that says you have to retire. I think I probably cut out for a second, but I'm recording on my end, so it's fine. But there's nothing that says you have
Okay.
to retire like at or work straight through full time and then retire at 65. And so we thought, Patrick and I, like intentionally made the decision to kind of downshift, which is like work less, but then consume less and have like a lower. All right, sorry, technical difficulties yet again on this damn podcast. Once I get to Chicago, this is never going to happen. Okay,
Sure.
yeah, sure.
Famous last words.
I know. So anyways, okay, so Patrick and I had this attitude of like when our kids are little, like super little, like under three, infant age, we're going to try to downshift. We're going to like work less, and have more free time, have more time with the family together. And then when they get into school age, we're going to ramp it back up again. And so basically, like since they were infants, we were just in grad school and just doing like small gigs and part-time work and remote work. But nothing ever full time. And that has been like the loveliest experience. However, now we're like trying to get back into real full-time work, and it's like, we're gonna have a mortgage. We're gonna have we I have work. I have a lot of work to do. And once we get back to Chicago, I think Patrick's gonna get back into full-time teaching, and it's gonna be like a totally different experience. It's gonna be a grind. It's like, get the kids up, get them out the door, get your work done for the day. And we're going to be like earning a lot and putting our money into a mortgage and, you know, and being super productive and ambitious. But it's going to be like a totally different lifestyle than having more freedom and less money. And so, I mean, I think in some cases, it's cool to think about your life in these periods of time, like where it would be best to have, which periods of time would it be best to have more free time and you can survive with less money. And vice versa. But I think, yeah, I mean, I think really thinking really intentionally about that. And I have no regrets really about having been around and having Patrick around too. Like it's even hard as a mom, even if you're like, you know, lucky enough to be able to stay home, that's still kind of lonely and difficult just by yourself with little kids. So it's been really great to have Patrick around. I don't regret this period of time where we were able to be around our kids at all, but like the mindset shift, the amount of productivity, it'll be good for us, I think. I mean, this is the period, this is like you have, you know, ambition and gumption in your 30s and 40s and 50s. Like, this is the time where you should be productive, where you should be putting things aside for your family, where you should be like, you know, getting a lot done. But yeah, man, it's already starting where it's going to be like a total grind. And you know, that's
Yeah,
okay.
and
It's just a different
yeah,
moment.
the model we followed was my wife was a stay-at-home homeschool mom. I was the breadwinner, and you know, there's that joke on online at least, and at least on some of the Twitter spaces, you know, that we are in. We see that longhouse
Yeah.
idea, and you know, like I jokingly tweeted one time that I was you know, leaving the longhouse to go out and you know whatever, because I was traveling for work and I was leaving the family. But you know, I think that we really underestimate how important the partnerships are in our marriages. Like, so many people view marriage right now as, instead of like, it's a partnership, and it's, you know, it's like, well, you know, my money, his money,
Right.
or you know, my money, her money,
Yeah.
as opposed to, hey, how can we partner? Because our project is building this family more
Right.
than, you know, whatever. So fully on board with being in the longhouse. That's what I chose, what I want. You know, I'll just say this, like I'm looking back on maybe part of what you're about to embark on to some degree. I still have, you know, more to go, but you know, I was thinking today, you know, when I look back on my life right now, and my youngest is 16, and I think, man, we've done okay. You know, we've
Yeah.
done okay raising good kids that are honest, that are hard workers, et cetera, that are capable. And I'm looking really forward to the next, you know, 10 or 15 years, and eventually having grandkids and things like that. Like, I didn't see myself wanting grandkids even 2 years ago, and now I'm at the point where I'm like, hey guys, you know, get going. You know, you guys need to get there. But yeah, like I'm starting to look at that, and I think, you know, if you think of your marriage as a partnership, kind of the way you are articulating, like, you know, you guys jointly making those decisions, that's just so critical. And being you know, jointed in that way, as you go through these transitions is super important. So yeah, kudos to you guys for that. And
And okay, so final
you know,
thoughts.
yeah, to add to that, I mean, I think that's what I think.
Sorry, we cut out for a second, but final
For
thoughts.
me?
No, yeah, you did, but it's okay. I'm just the time I'm being a bad host. The timing is awkward. But wait, are you there? Can you hear me? Okay, now.
I am here. I'm here.
Okay, good.
Yep.
Okay.
Yeah, I can hear you. I can see you, everything. Yeah.
Okay, good. So yeah, so I guess final thoughts on you know, a lot of people who listen to this podcast are the kinds of people who are thinking big picture about where to settle in the face of potential instability. And so I think a lot of people are feeling this instability in the United States, in the developed world. I think for a while, I thought it's a good thing, and I still think it's a good thing. I talked about this on the nomadism episode, but I still think it's a good thing that we're keeping this property and that you have the ability to escape if you need to in times of like real crisis. Like if we need to bug out to Uruguay, we can, and we'll have a place to go. But yeah, thoughts on the benefits of going back home, I guess. I mean, I think it's cool for people to have adventure. I'm kind of ambivalent about prescribing things to people, but like we described in this episode, I think we were talking a lot about like the specific, relationships you have, the family, the life course of your family, how old the kids are, where they thrive, all of those things should figure into it. But for you in particular, yeah, just it would be cool to kind of end the episode thinking about, going home, what have been the benefits of that?
Well, I think, I thought a lot about where to be if everything goes to hell, and there's this, there's like the American Redoubt, like the Idaho, Montana, that kind of east of the Cascadian Mountains and all that, which is a very attractive region. I mean, honestly, like there's a part of me that's
Lovely.
like, oh yeah, that
It's
sounds
pretty.
awesome,
Yeah.
but there's also my wife's from Venezuela. So when you look at Venezuela and you see the devastation that's been wrought by the corruption and all the different problems they've had, and you see the refugee crisis that created in Latin America and that it's creating in the southern border now, because I mean, some of the videos I've seen lately, it's been like, hey, de donde están, whatever, and they're like, are they donde son or whatever they said, and they're like, Venezuela, so you're like,
Yeah.
man, like these people are so displaced. And I always ask my wife, I'm like, because my wife started really longing for Venezuelan like people. She's like, I don't have my people. And I started almost regretting, there's some consideration I have about home right now that I've never had in my life. I almost regretting that I married this, Venezuelan woman and took her away from her people, right?
Right.
There's a consideration you have to think about there. I love her and I don't want anything different in my life, but it's just really made me, sad for her because that is a real pain, and then the other thing, the other th aspect of that is religion. People do the same thing with religion, but I was saying to her, like, like at some point you have to stay and fight. And so maybe things are going to go bad, and you'd be better off, quote unquote, in Idaho, in the Palouse Valley in Idaho,
Yeah.
as Rawls talks about in his novels, right? Because you talked to Jonathan, right?
Yeah,
Jonathan
yeah,
Rawls.
yeah, yeah.
So his dad's novels talk about the Palouse Valley up there in Idaho. Maybe you'd be better off there, but is the family connections that you have, the community connections you have, what do they have value? And so when I start balancing that, it's like, if things are going to go bad, maybe I'm better off staying and fighting. And so my question right now is like, how do I stay and fight more than picking the very, very best place to be? And I think you're basically saying the same thing with moving back to Chicago, because any rational, spreadsheet brain calculation, you'd be like, well, not
Yeah,
Chicago, right?
totally, which is what I was, which is why I know the spreadsheet brain people because I'm one of them or can be.
So what we've decided to do is we're doubling down. We're like, hey, Newberry is our town. We're gonna lock arms with people here in Newberry, and we're gonna make this the best place we can make it. And if things start getting dicey, hopefully we can grow enough pigs, or we can, grow enough chickens, or have enough eggs to share with our community, and we're gonna be part of the solution, and help each other out. And we've got we're building community, both within our kind of our religious community that we've been part of, and then also within the community at large. And it's really, that's what we've decided. I think if I were, if I had the means, or if I had maybe the family network that I could convince everyone to do this, maybe I would say, hey, my brother has a place up in North Carolina. Maybe he plants 2 acres of apples, and I have my brother down by the beach. Maybe he plants an acre of orange trees, and we have like a little network of trade or something, you know. I kind of thought of that, you know. But I think ultimately it's about community. So I think it's more about finding the community that you're willing to commit to and that you feel comfortable and you can build relationships of trust. And I think there's a lot of ways to optimize beyond place. If place has meaning, if the history has meaning, if the family connections and the community connections have meaning, maybe they're worth staying and fighting for wherever that is, instead of trying to optimize based on the actual geographic location. So that's my thoughts on it right now.
Totally. And one thing I've been thinking about is, people always backwards construct like narrative narrative histories of their own, choices or whatever. But if I'm thinking now, like I kind of had to go through all of this. I couldn't have just, I think, settled in Chicago. I probably always would have been asking what if questions. And so having gone rural and having like really been stubborn and pigheaded, like I'm doing this thing, I'm gonna, go find this super stable place, learned a lot about like stable communities and rural living and, different sustainable like livelihood strategies that we were able to do without any real difficulty. It did give me a big sense of accomplishment and like internal resilience, psychological resilience. And I think for a while I was thinking, I'm going to be in this rural South American place. I'm going to bring like the lessons from this the sustainable life back to the United States to the extent possible, which is part of why I got on Twitter and have started the podcast. But I think at a certain point you're going to have to, or at least this is what I'm when I was laughing at myself constructing this narrative, bringing those lessons and proving them in Chicago, like proving the lessons, proving about like family resilience, community resilience, thinking about I know that I'm not going to be able to turn my brain off of thinking about like the local food shed, local supply chains, informal backyard production. I mean, I know people already, like in my neighborhood, a bunch of people have chickens already. So like tying that all together, all of these lessons, and seeing if I can really prove the model in Chicago. And then talking about that process for people, because I think it's helpful. It's really easy to say from afar, like, we'll just figure it out. Take my lessons and you guys just figure it out. But like trying to prove the model in Chicago. And yeah, kind of leaning into all of the community and stuff. I think it'll be a cool lesson. Hopefully I can share some insights with people. But yeah, I do think also I've tweeted about this a bunch, but like I worry about my family. I worry about them being in this place. And I think there is an extent to which you can vote with your feet. Like I'm gonna plant myself here. And all of my effort, all of my ambition, all of my agency, I'm gonna put it here and see what happens. I'm gonna like, and I just tweeted this the other day, like the contrarian in me wants to send my kids to public school. I'm gonna send them to public school. I know this school. I went to a similar kind of school. It's Chicago Public Schools, which have a terrible reputation, but I know this particular school. There's a lot of really good families in it. I know the families. So what can we do if we like really put our attention in an institution, put our attention in a neighborhood, get involved in Girl Scouts. What can I do by instead of like just critiquing those institutions by like engaging with them and putting my all of
Well,
my attention and goodwill toward them?
I think it goes back to kind of just the attitude that we've built in our culture, in our society, at least, maybe not culture, but in our society of consumerism, because we think of all of those things as products that we consume. We don't think of them as products that we build or that we construct as part of the society or the culture or community we live in. And I think, making a kind of a decisive, definitive decision, I am going to be part of building this as opposed to I'm going to consume this as a product is like the critical thing. One more thing I would say is like there are so many people that are thinking about optimizing geography over community. And if you're thinking that way and you move to a place that you've never been, you've never, have any roots there or whatever, there's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing wrong with that. I totally encourage people to feel that that's what they need to do. Like, do it. but go into it knowing that you're about to go integrate into an existing community, and don't go try to take over the community. And it's one of those things that it feels to me like a lot of people, like this is a really maybe the wrong analogy, but let's just say if there's a very happy couple, there's a man and a woman that are maybe newlyweds, a young married couple, and there's a woman that really likes that guy. If she gets the guy, she destroys exactly what she thought she wanted. Like if she got him, she destroys what was good about him. And so you can do the same thing to a community.
Yeah, this is a great
Like,
analogy.
oh, do you like it? Okay. I wasn't sure if I was going too far there. But if you go into a community and you say, I love this community. Look at it's so quaint, it's so thing. And you go in there and you start wrecking stuff and you start telling the farmers, I can't believe you use Grazon on your hay field. You're destroying the environment. You're such a jackass. You're going to end up destroying the things that made that community great. And not that you shouldn't use that influence, but you've got to do it in a building way, not in a just a critical way. Be constructive. I don't know. I get really passionate about this because I don't want to offend anybody on a political basis or even environmental basis, because I don't want people using Grazon on their hay field. By the same token, these guys have been farming here. The guy I buy hay from uses Grazon and he sprays for army worms and stuff like that. I don't have a source for, the purest organic coastal Bermuda hay in the world. I don't have a source for that. Am I going to walk over to him and go, oh, you're an idiot, scram? I'm not. I'm going to say, hey, I'm going to be able to move fertility from his land to my land. I'm going to keep it in the pasture so it doesn't impact other crops I want to grow. I can't use that manure as compost. That's the compromise I have to make. I understand that. If I have an opportunity to talk to him about it, I will, but I'm going to do it in a constructive way. I'm not going to be like, I don't want to use the term, but I'm not going to be a Karen. You know what I mean? Like, I'm not going to be, wagging my finger at him and saying, hey, you're a bad pirate, you're a bad person, and you don't understand ecology or the land. That guy's the guy I buy hay from. His father cleared that land with a mule team and goats. He understands that ecology better than I do. I am not going to have anything to say about that. I mean, listen to what he has to say.
Totally. And okay, so I just want to bring this up because it's funny because Nate said the same thing in his episode, which was thinking about your relationship to a place like a marriage, which is like the marriage isn't between two perfect individuals who agree all the time. It's a commitment to do something productive together despite the challenges or despite the difficulties. And so I think similarly, thinking about a relationship with a place, I love this. I never thought of it this way, but I think a lot of my thoughts on doomer optimism and other people have drawn on this duality between productive and consumptive, and thought of it in terms of these really like basic material things like baking bread and doing a homestead and all this stuff. But there is also a way in which you can be a productive member of society via like constructing institutions and thinking of yourself as an active and responsible member of that institution, as opposed to, and I think a lot of people kind of fall into this consumerist mindset with this. I've gone back and forth with a lot of people. This local public school, I know a lot of people who send their kids there, a lot of people who have been teachers and administrators in Chicago public schools, and they're super active and they're very conscientious parents. And those are my people, like active agency, conscientious moms who I agree with, like values wise, who want to raise their kids in the way we were raised in the 80s and 90s. Chicago public schools is a behemoth that is like needs to be contended with. But at the same time, if I just sit back and say, like, Chicago public schools is a disaster, that institution's going to fade away without like active engagement with people like us who have agency, who want to be involved and want to be constructive. And so I think about all of these kind of social institutions in similar ways, but I never really put it in this dynamic. But I mean, you could also be a producer, in the sense of social institutions, showing up, helping.
That's exactly what I was trying to say, because I've seen it when I coached like YMCA teams and stuff like that, where people come over, they don't show up. They show up at a game, their kid doesn't play as much as they want or whatever, and they're like, this coach is horrible. It's like, where, look, you're not the team mom. Like, where have you been?
Yeah.
Like don't approach it as a consumer. Hey, how can I help? I'd love to be able to be involved. What can I do to support you? I don't have time to be here every week, but hey, could I do, people are looking at it as a product they consume. I paid $35 for my kid to play. Well, I mean, it's the YMCA lady,
Yeah, exactly.
and I think, so I think there's definitely that relationship, and we're taking it to a different level. Like, we're trying to get this farm store going where we want to basically create like a permanent farmers market type
Yep.
vibe, where we're going to say, hey, there's a local grocery. You can get local zero waste products, local, either local and or zero waste products, so that you can, take care of your local food shed, as you were saying, while supporting local farmers, while doing better for the environment and for the other things. And it's, hey, we might lose everything for that, but we're going to try to make it happen and see
Well, and
what comes of it.
let's end with this because I don't know how much you've gotten to talk about this, but you are making a brick and mortar store that is basically like a permanent farmers market that's specifically going to be focused on local or zero waste. As you say, let's just end with this. How does this tie into your feeling of going home? And I mean, like the what initially pops up that's so obvious to me is like really contributing to the community by. And a lot of these rural communities like do have difficulty. One of the thing that keeps coming up is like Dollar General, Walmart, like there's not a lot of commerce options. And then that actually does have an impact on the community, the kinds of food they have access to, the kinds of goods. So yeah, let's end
I
with
mean,
that.
yeah, that's
This is
great.
your
I mean,
taking a stand.
the big barrier for us is going to be making it accessible from a pricing perspective. But people are sick of having only the options available at Walmart and Food Lion, which are the two big supermarkets here. There's Dollar General a little further out of town, but there's basically Walmart and Food Lion. They want other options. They want cleaner options. If we can make it accessible and make it part of their routine, going back to what I was saying earlier about when you leave home, you're not part of the routine anymore. So farmers markets are essentially like a vacation for a consumer. They are not part of the routine. So we want to create this as a part of their routine. We're going to offer delivery within the city limits, within certain parts of the city, and we're hoping to be able to provide, beef, lamb, turkey, chicken and duck eggs, fresh dairy, raw milk. Produce, cut flowers, and then some zero waste products. We're hoping to source everything within 60 miles of here. We might make a few compromises on some food staples, but all of the farm products will be sourced within 60 miles of here. Mushrooms, greens, microgreens, etc. So I don't know how long it's going to take us to get it done, but we're hoping to open as soon as we can. It's just that it's a significant investment, and I'm probably going to do a Kickstarter to try to help get it going.
Okay.
I've been my daughter has designed some t-shirt designs. We're going to try to get those up soon and ask people to help us by buying a t-shirt. So
Nice.
look
Okay,
for
well get that
that.
Kickstarter up before this episode comes out, which is several
Okay.
from now, so then we can link to it.
That'd be
Okay,
great.
this was awesome, Jeffrey. Thank you so much. It was very cathartic for me to work through some of these things. When I did the episode with Nate, we hadn't yet like fully decided, but since then have purchased or made an offer on a house that is closing soon. So really live streaming my life here.
Yeah,
This was
yeah.
really helpful and really cool, very insightful. So thanks so much. This is awesome.
Great. I enjoyed it. Thank you for having me. And I'm sure we'll be in touch soon. So good
Yeah.
luck with the closing, and we'll keep you posted on our progress as well.
All right, sounds good. Thanks. Have a good one.
Great. Thanks. You too.